the state is something that seems to be the structure that is being operated now from the national headquarters.
Louisiana, in other parts of the country, we know it particularly here when it comes to detention. You have Mahmoud Khalil, who is the Columbia student who was imprisoned in Louisiana. You have Rumeysa Ozturk, the Tufts graduate student who was imprisoned in Louisiana. Talk about the overall detention complex in Louisiana.
Louisiana has a history, a terrible history, of being the incarceration capital of the world. And that is no different when it comes now to immigration detention. Louisiana's number two when it comes to the state with the second largest detained immigrant population in the country, next to Texas. However, we're not a border state. We also don't have a large immigrant population by numbers. Instead, what Louisiana does is it receives a lot of people who are detained around the country. And so the additional aspect of what happens in Louisiana is that we have these very rural, isolated detention centers in central and northern Louisiana, which are very far away from major metropolitan or from major population centers, which means what you end up with is people removed from their legal and support systems. So when you had someone like Mahmoud Khalil being moved down here from New York, what you had was removing him from his social network, from people who could assist him, from being able to provide him with assistance. Same thing with Rumeysa Ozturk. And these were highly publicized cases, places where folks had large support networks. And so when we deal with folks who don't have those support networks, who don't have that publicity, who don't have that kind of support, and you have them in such a remote, isolated area, what you end up is basically warehousing folks without giving them an opportunity to fight their case and be able to present a viable case through actual due process.
You can't help but notice that New Orleans is a blue city in a red state. Louisiana has the most detention beds outside of Texas. Can you talk about the consent decree that was overturned last month, Omedo?
The consent decree was overturned last month by the Justice Department, and they wanted to get rid of it. It had been in place for over a decade here in Louisiana here in New Orleans, that had not allowed the local sheriff's office to cooperate with ICE. Now, the new sheriff, we don't know exactly what she's going to do. But what it does is it removes this tool that existed, which was originally implemented because of previous abuses that had been determined by a federal court that New Orleans police, New Orleans Sheriff's Office should not be cooperating, and had ordered the Sheriff's Office not to cooperate. Without that consent decree in place, it's now up to the sheriff. And so there is a movement on the ground from advocacy groups and from other organizers to push the sheriff to continue to have that kind of policy. But we'll see what comes from that.
And can you talk about the people you represent? I mean, I think it's really important, not only in New Orleans, but around the country. A number of the people being picked up are going to their court hearings. They are following the rules, and they end up being arrested.
Yeah, the majority of people who are being arrested, the majority of calls that we're receiving are from folks who are going through the process, whether they be children who originally applied through the special immigrant juvenile status process and are awaiting their ability to apply for residency, whether it's spouses of U.S. citizens who are going to their interviews and are being picked up, whether it's people who have immigration court hearings and have filed their applications and are attending the hearings, are going, again, they're doing it, quote unquote, the right way, and that's who is being picked up. Those are the folks who are the low-hanging fruit. Those are the folks who are going to be targeted. There's a reason that these officers are going to work sites and not necessarily doing in-depth investigations to identify folks that they claim are a danger to the community. Instead, what they're doing is they're taking folks out of our community, our neighbors, our friends, our family members, and that's who they're detaining and they're sending into these terrible detention centers in order to try to quickly deport them from the country.
Omero Lopez, I want to thank you for being with us. Do you have a final comment on the city council hearing that was held yesterday as mics were turned off on person after person who was calling for ICE-free zones?
Yeah, we hope that city council will take a stance. We understand that they don't necessarily have a ton of power over federal actions, but the point here is about the values that the city stands for and what we are going to demonstrate to our community and to our residents of who we support, what we support, and what we stand for in the city.
Omeda Lopez is the legal director of ISLA, the Immigration Services and Legal Advocacy, based in New Orleans, Louisiana. As we go from New Orleans to Minneapolis, we turn to Minnesota, where more than 100 federal immigration agents are conducting operations this week as President Trump escalates his attacks on the Somali community in the state. The Trump administration halted green card and citizenship applications from Somalis and people from 18 other countries after last week's fatal shooting of a National Guardsman near the White House. One of those guardsmen died. Another is fighting for his life. That was when an Afghan man who once worked for the CIA shot two members of the guard. During a cabinet meeting Tuesday, Trump attacked the Somali community, making comments that were later widely condemned.
I don't want them in our country, I'll be honest with you. Okay? Somebody would say, oh, that's not politically correct. I don't care. I don't want them in our country. Their country's no good for a reason. Their country stinks, and we don't want them in our country. I could say that about other countries, too. I could say it about other countries, too. We don't want them to hell. We have to rebuild our country. You know, our country's at a tipping point. We could go bad. We're at a tipping point. I don't know if people mind me saying that, but I'm saying it. We could go one way or the other, and we're going to go the wrong way if we keep taking in garbage into our country. Ilhan Omar is garbage. She's garbage. Her friends are garbage.
President Trump's comments at a cabinet meeting on Tuesday. Congressmember Ilhan Omar, a Somali-American first refugee congressmember, called President Trump's comments and his obsession with her, as she described it, creepy, said he needs help. Trump made similar remarks on Wednesday. On Thursday, Democratic Minnesota Governor Tim Walz called Trump's racist tirades dangerous. He also noted the vast majority of Somalis who live in Minnesota are American citizens and legal permanent residents.
It appears very little's being done. They bring these folks in from Texas or somewhere like that. I'm sure they're too cold to get out of their cars to harass people. But they're doing it in New Orleans. It's all about show. It's not about. They demonized an entire group, potentially 60,000 people, based on racial profiling. There are only about 300 people with the protective status that we're here.
For more, we're joined in Minneapolis by Jelani Hussein, Executive Director of CARE. That's the Council on American-Islamic Relations. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Jelani Hussein. If you can start off by responding to President Trump's comments, calling the Somali community garbage, and singling out Ilhan Omar, calling her garbage, as he said, that they should leave the country. You were born in Somalia. You came to the United States as a child. Can you talk about the danger this puts you in when the president of the United States talks about an entire community in this way?
Well, I think it's extremely—thank you for having me. I think it's extremely disappointing, and especially I think Americans— across this country should be abhorred. And most importantly, you know, we understand why we're being attacked. We believe it's actually because of our success. Somali Americans have been in the United States now for more than 30 years. We came here partially because of our refugee status. And the doors were actually opened by George Bush Sr. And, you know, the fact that this attack is happening to this community and continues to happen, we believe is because of the fact that we feel the three trifecta. We are a black immigrant, and we know that President Trump continues to attack black people, whether they're descendants of slaves here in the United States or African immigrants. We see that majority of the countries that have been banned are African. Also, the fact of immigrants, and of course, being a Muslim. And I think Those trifectas continue to make it easy to scapegoat. We know that there are foreign entities that want, including Israel, as well as the Hindu extremists in this country, who want to reverse the course of what is actually taking place in this country, which is, for the first time, Republicans waking up to these wars, to these never-ending wars, and the carnage of what happened in Gaza. And so we know that that's an element as part of the reason why this community is being targeted.
You're saying because it's a largely Muslim community, Jelani?
Yes, absolutely. And I think that, you know, there's an effort to try to demonize Muslims. This has always been the case. If you demonize Muslims, then you can get away with killing Muslims abroad. This has always been the case, from the Afghanistan war to the Iraq war. We know that. And I think many young Republicans and many, obviously, progressive Democrats and Democrats across this country, and perhaps the future of this country, do not want to have a government that spends majority of its time in wars of killing other people and not taking care of Americans here. I think that's at the center of it. However, you know, it's been interesting to have these 100 plus ICE agents descend on our state. And so far, what we've heard is literally them detaining U.S. citizens. I think that yesterday we learned that they've maybe only picked up five Somali Americans who are going through the immigration process.
I'm wondering if you could also comment on what happened in November, Texas, Republican Governor Greg Abbott declaring your organization, the Council on American Islamic Relations, CARE, the country's largest Muslim civil rights group, a foreign terrorist organization. It's not even clear that he has the ability as a governor of a state to classify an organization in this way.
I think it's the, I think it fits the same pattern of behavior that we have seen, where Israeli first politicians are doing the bidding of Netanyahu. We know that CARE has actually had a spy who had connections to the Netanyahu government, who infiltrated one of our CARE chapters. We are the largest civil rights organization. It is because of the fact of how effective we are in ensuring the rights of American Muslims and others that we become a target for these groups. And so, you know, it's been widely condemned. And the reality is this is where they go. You know, this is the, kind of the targeting that we have seen, and we expect that. And perhaps there'll be even more. But it's falling, I believe, on deaf ears, because more and more people are reading now, more and more people are awake, and there's a younger generation of Americans, I am really hopeful, will not be duped by the same type of rhetoric that we have seen in the past.
So you have the largest Somali American population in the United States, in the Twin Cities, Minneapolis, St. Paul, around, 84,000 people, with approximately 73% of Somali immigrants being naturalized citizens. This is imperiling Republican candidates and political figures. I've seen people concerned about whether they will be elected. There are Somali Republicans and Democrats. I saw a father and business owner yesterday saying he voted for Trump. How does he talk to his children about him calling, Trump calling his children garbage? But if you can talk about the citizenship and President Trump threatening to take away, if this is even in his power, re-examine naturalized citizens?
Yeah, I mean, these threats have been there. It's part of their plan. I know that we estimate about 58% or a little more than that of Somali Americans are actually born here. So we have a pretty young community, and about almost 80%, actually, we have some higher numbers of those who are either lawful residents or majority being U.S. citizens. We've been here for 30-plus years. We have built ourselves to be a fabric of this great state of Minnesota, not only in the urban core, but in greater parts of the state. And so, yeah, this effort to try to do that is interesting. But it is part of this effort to try to, again, target immigration in this country. And I believe it's not only racist, but it's a plan that is to kind of respond to that kind of white nationalist effort that we have heard for so much. To the other point politically, you know, Somali Americans, just like any other community, are not monolithic. You know, we have seen actually a sharp increase of Somali Americans supporting Republicans in the state of Minnesota, including President Trump. And there are many of them. Some have publicly declare that they are out of the Republican Party, and others are asking hard questions. And here's the interesting thing. You know, the Republican leadership in the state of Minnesota understand what is happening. In fact, you know, they are kind of right now silent and not choosing to come up and say, you know, these our community, this Somali American community, and many who even voted for them are not garbage, and the president was out of line.
Can you tell your own story, Jelani Hussein, how you came to the United States from Somalia?
You know, I this is one thing that I think people don't understand. You know, as an immigrant child or refugee child, nobody wants to leave home. I never, as a young child, ever imagined leaving anywhere. I remember living next to the airport, and I would see planes leave. And, you know, as a child, you might have wanted to get on a plane and see things, but home is always home. And because of that civil war, which I hope we get a chance sometime to talk about that, because people don't realize how United States foreign policy plays into destabilization, including my own country, because Somalia was part of the Cold War that the United States and Russia interfered with our own government and created us to have wars with our neighbors in Ethiopia. But I left Somalia and as a child, and I came here to Minnesota. And, you know, Minnesota, and my father always says that, you know, we came to one of the coldest places, but we found people with warm hearts. And today, you know, I'm as Minnesotan as you can get. And there's something unique about Minnesota. Minnesota is, also has a large number of other immigrants, including folks from Laos, the Hmong population, and as well as a large other Latino and South American community. And it's interesting, you know, it's starting to be really unique. And for those who have visited us here in the state of Minnesota would find that, you know, robust diversity that is growing in the heart of the Twin Cities. But Minnesota has not only embraced Somali community, but, you know, you start to see that our food and the things that we do are also part of that, the growth of the state. And so, you know, I was just joking to reporters that I was in a deer stand a couple of weeks ago, even though I didn't get a deer. And that's what it is. You know, we when we come together and we live in this great country and try to make it even a better country, that is really the story of the immigrant community, and that's something that is not only hopeful, but in this moment we are really asking, especially Minnesotans and folks across the country, to speak up. And I know, and I've heard from Republicans, individuals, I've heard of so many people who are not only shocked and dismayed by what the president has said. And yesterday we had faith leaders who spoke up, and many other community members are speaking up. And yesterday we also called for a National Day of Action on Saturday, December 13th, for folks to speak up across this country to stand with Somali Americans, but also other immigrants in this country. You know, this is a native land, and other than the forced enslavement of African Americans, everyone else has really an immigrant story. And that's the story we need to tell. And, you know, I hope this message goes to you know, Melania. I know she is an immigrant herself, and I think she, in this moment, could potentially speak to the president and maybe even present a different story to the president. Demonizing an entire community for the act of individuals is wrong. I also think for many people who are asking these questions, you know, this is the oldest story, using crime to define a community. This is what media has done. They constantly lead with crime and subject it without really giving it nuance. And that's why today we have one of the largest mass incarceration of people of color, even though crime doesn't have race or anything else. So this is a moment, I think, for our nation. We have seen vile things that the president has said, but in these moments, we need to come together and respond. But I also am asking for people to know, especially those on social media today, who are projecting this hatred toward the Somali community. We believe some of those people are actually acting on behalf of foreign governments, and we need those individuals to be investigated. And if they are acting for foreign government, then they need to register in that manner.
Jelanis Hussein, I want to thank you so much for being with us, Executive Director of CARE Minnesota. That's the Council of American Islamic Relations, born in Somalia, came to the U.S. as a child. As the U.S. blows up another boat, this one in the Pacific, and senators watch video of two September strike survivors clinging for life to a boat for more than 40 minutes, countering Secretary Hegseth's claims of fog of war. We'll speak with a lawyer for the family of another boat strike, this one a Colombian father of four. The family's challenging the strikes. Stay with us. As I Walk, written by the Lebanese musical composer Marcel Khalifa, performed here in New York at a Gaza Benefit for NYC Palestinian Youth Choir this week. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Pentagon's announced the U.S. blew up another boat in the Eastern Pacific, killing four people, claiming the boat was carrying drugs, but once again offering no proof. This comes as the controversy continues to grow over the first U.S. boat strike, September 2nd, when the U.S. targeted and killed two men who had survived an initial attack. Nine others were killed in the first strike, September 2nd. The U.S. has now killed at least 87 people and 22 strikes on boats since September. The U.S. has not provided proof that the vessel's activities or the identities of those on board. But now the family of a fisherman from Colombia has come forward and has filed the first formal challenge to the U.S. military strikes. In a petition filed with the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, the family says a strike on September 15th killed 42-year-old Alejandro Andres Carranza Medina, a fisherman from Santa Marta, Colombia, a father of four. His family says he was fishing for tuna and marlin off Colombia's Caribbean coast when his boat was bombed, that he wasn't smuggling drugs. At the time, President Trump claimed the strike killed three narco terrorists.
We have proof. All you have to do is look at the cargo that was, like, it spattered all over the ocean, big bags of cocaine and fentanyl all over the place. And it was, plus we have recorded evidence that they were leaving.
A video released at the time shows a small boat exploding in flames. For more, we're joined in Pittsburgh by international human rights attorney Dan Kovalik. He filed the petition with the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights on behalf of the family. Welcome to Democracy Now! Explain what they are saying, Dan.
Thanks for having me, Amy. Yeah, I mean, it's pretty simple. The claim that the family is making is that Alejandro was murdered. You know, I was asked by one reporter, you know, was Alejandro innocent? And I, you know, my response was, all these people who've been killed are innocent because you're innocent until proven guilty. None of these people were charged. None of them were put on trial and convicted. This is not how a civilized nation should act, just murdering people on the high seas without proof, without trial.
So explain, has the Trump administration gotten in touch? Has the Colombian government stood up for the victims of this boat strike? Has the U.S. government presented any evidence that, in fact, the person you're representing, Andres Carranza Medina, was in fact a narco terrorist?
No, the U.S. has presented no evidence. They have not responded at all to our petition. And in terms of the Colombian government, the truth is I got in touch with the family of Alejandro through the Petro administration, through President Petro of Colombia. So they are standing up to this. They are actually President Petro's creating a commission of lawyers to investigate more killings that have happened of Colombians in the Caribbean.
So explain the response in Colombia to the killing of your client. You say in the petition the family's been threatened by right-wing paramilitaries for speaking out about Mr. Carranza's death. Can you tell us more?
Yeah, well, you know, the sad thing is that right-wing paramilitaries, which the United States helped to create and helped to fund for many years, still exist in Colombia. And so, yeah, when the family came out publicly about the murder, they did receive death threats from right-wing paramilitaries. And in fact, they ended up being displaced as a result of these threats. But again, the government of Colombia is behind them, is supporting them. And there's a lot of outrage in Colombia about these killings. And what's happened, by the way, Amy, is that, you know, again, fishermen are now stopping going out to sea to fish because they're afraid they're just going to be blown up, which is, you know, makes sense. I mean, I wouldn't go out there either.
Explain what it means to bring a petition in front of the Inter-American Human Rights Commission. What is this commission? What power does it have over the United States?
Yes. Well, first of all, the Inter-American Commission is part of the Organization of American States. We brought the claims under the American Declaration for the Rights and Duties of Man, which is the oldest human rights instrument in the world. It was actually agreed to in Bogota, Colombia, in 1948, even before the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was agreed to. And the commission does have jurisdiction over the United States to investigate the United States for these types of crimes, which these are crimes, and to require the U.S. to respond to them. In the end, they will issue a report making recommendations, we hope, for compensation for the family, also telling the U.S. to stop these killings. In the end, you know, the U.S. could choose to disregard these recommendations, but we think with a positive decision from the commission combined with public pressure, which is building, that we can bring justice to this family and stop these killings on the high seas.
You filed the first formal complaint. Do you expect others to follow?
Oh, yes, we do, of course. And, you know, again, the Colombian government is reaching out, trying to find more families, and I am happy to take on more cases. I think this is one of the most significant human rights cases right now, certainly in the hemisphere. I mean, because it's not just about, well, killings, but it's about the rule of law. You know, it's about the idea that that a government like the United States could just murder people based on mere accusations. As I say, it's no different than, you know, going down the street here in Pittsburgh and the cops saying, oh, I think that guy's dealing in drugs and just blowing that person's brains out. No
final
one
question.
Thinks that's correct.
We just have 10 seconds. Do you hold out hope for the Senate investigation, both Republican and Democrat raising serious questions about these bombings? 5 seconds.
I am at least hopeful, Amy. Again, I think the tide is turning against these killings. The American public is disgusted by them. So, yeah,
we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much, Dan Kovalik, international human rights attorney. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
This is Mac DeMarco, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby, Les Chablis.
Anya dreams of becoming the world's greatest chef. Max and Maria dream of skating for gold. Alex dreams of a life free of needles and pain beyond the walls of a hospital room. Right now in Canada, more than 10,000 children are being treated for cancer, and one in five will not survive. When you support Childhood Cancer Canada, you help fund critical research and provide financial assistance to families in their fight. Give life to dreams beyond kids' cancer at livefordreams.ca.